Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And welcome, my wonderful audience, the best in the world, the most informed, the most truly caring, the most scientifically oriented, the most psychologically oriented, and probably the most spiritually oriented audience, certainly in that combination, in the world. I delight in talking to you. Today, I'm going to spend talking about, by myself, no guest, about antidepressant drugs, and especially in regard to children, but really, really actually in relation to everyone, I'm sure, as I move along. I now have three resource centers, special resource centers, up on my website. Two of them that are directly within the website now are the Antipsychotic Drug and Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center. And now also right within the website is the Antidepressant Drug Resource and Information Center. They're both easily accessible right at the top of my page, where I have a little red heading that says Selective Highlights of Dr. Breggin's Work, or something like that. And in the left-hand column for Selective Highlights, about number 6, the last one down, as of 5 minutes ago, thanks to my wonderful research assistant and also more and more my webmaster, Ian Goddard, my friend of decades, I've worked with him for decades, Ian Goddard. He just got up just this moment before the show started, up in its proper place on the website, right under Selected Highlights, the Antidepressant Drug Resource Center. Now, the third one is the ECT Resource Center. You can connect to that through the website, and it's also stands alone, ectresources.com.org. Now, why do I do these things? There's a huge amount of work in them for this Antidepressant Drug Resource Center. I had to put together, right now we're over 120 PDFs, which I have categorized into a dozen separate categories. another stage to go will be I'll have little descriptions in each of the categories. Now I just have a heading for them, so you know what they are, like children or apathy caused by the drugs, or one very big one is mania and psychosis caused by antidepressants. Another big one is violence caused by the antidepressants, and a huge one is suicide caused by the antidepressants. Then there's a bunch more all about these drugs. The children's one has just some very important articles on it that everybody should be aware of, and I may talk about them before I get finished today. So why do I do this? I mean, you know, some of these, the ECT one in particular, I think it took me hundreds of hours to compose it. Well, as most of you know, who listen to this show, I've been doing research since I was a teeny bopper, starting back at age 18 at Harvard when I joined and then ran the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital program. I've been writing books and articles and giving talks about psychiatry, and not all critical, although the biological psychiatry approaches I've taken have been critical, but often about psychotherapy and psychosocial and educational alternatives. But I've been researching and writing books, 20 more than 20 now, more than 50 scientific articles of my own. I've been writing and researching for decades. And many of these articles that I have stacked up in my files are not readily available to people. I cite them in my articles, but they're not readily available in PDF form and with little explanations to zero people in on them. So my goal has been for all kinds of folks, prescribers and scientists, professionals, medical experts, patients, families, to have really easy, good access to the way I've thematically organized my research on various areas, including particularly right now, these three. There'll be more: antidepressants, antipsychotic drugs, and ECT. I'd like to do one on lobotomy because, I ran a campaign to stop lobotomy that took from coming back in the early 70s. It was just a big push to bring it back. And I conducted a one-person campaign, eventually working with Congress and the Black Caucus and the conservative senators, and working with women's groups and children's groups. I eventually worked very hard and for several years and mostly stopped the return of lobotomy and psychosurgery in the Western world. And I got tons of articles about that too that I should at some point make into a resource center. So these resource centers, everything on it is free. I think of it as in part as a legacy. 30 years from now when I'm gone, I'll have kept that thing updated and it'll be there. And it's also just for immediate use by anybody who wants to be able to go in, look at a category of scientific articles, antidepressants, antipsychotics, and TD, ECT, and be able to go down it and search the items and pull them up and get a good clean PDF. And that's been no easy job. And I really want to thank Ian Goddard and also in earlier years and occasionally still working for us, some of my other assistants here in the office on occasion now, including a lovely, lovely woman named Missy. So there it is, a lot of work out there. I hope it proves to be very useful to you. And today I'm going to use it as the basis of talking about antidepressant drugs. Well, what are antidepressant drugs? The first thing that's so important to know is they're not antidepressants. There is no such thing as an antidepressant drug. Love is an antidepressant. Spirituality can be an antidepressant. Hard work is an antidepressant. Exercise is an antidepressant. Eating well is an antidepressant. There are no biochemical antidepressants, because when you put a neurotoxin into the brain, and anything that changes, modifies your brain is harming it, basically. All these drugs are neurotoxins. They have nothing to do with depression at all. What they basically do is they flatten your emotions. As I talked about in an earlier show on the antipsychotic drugs, all psychiatric drugs are basically not caring drugs. They keep us from caring. Now, the antidepressants are insidious because initially they may give you a good feeling of euphoria. That euphoria is from brain dysfunction. It's not a realistic improvement of your life. It's a dangerous condition to be in. But doctors and patients will view it with approval. Patients don't know any better, and the doctors don't want to know any better or communicate anything about this to the patient, that it's actually a neurological damage that causes their euphoria. In fact, when I do legal cases and I look at records, what I commonly see before a manic episode that leads to horrific harm to the patient and family and sometimes even large groups of people, one of the first things I see is that the antidepressant, maybe Paxil or Zoloft, one of the SSRIs, Celexa, Lexapro, and so on, that one of these drugs has been given. The patient comes in maybe a week later, if it's somebody who follows up his patients or her patients, comes in a week later and says, I've never felt better in my life. And the doctor puts this down like it's a great thing. Like a great thing. But what does it mean when somebody feels, I've never felt better in my life after taking a chemical that disrupts brain function? Well, it's no different than if the person had been given cocaine in the office and told the doc after a few minutes, I've never felt better in my life. It's not very different than people who drink alcohol as the best way to feel better in their lives. A chemical high is not a good thing. And in the case of the antidepressants, it's a particularly bad sign because very likely the next time the patient's going to come in, they're going to say, I've got racing thoughts. Now my mind's spinning. They probably won't say racing thoughts, although nowadays people know what know that that's a phenomena. They might say, I'm not sleeping well. And we're at the early stages, very possibly there, of a manic episode, a very destructive event in a human being's life. I have many forensic patients who have committed violence while manic. They've got manic psychosis, imagined that their loved one was a Martian here to destroy the world. They've embezzled, doing it so openly that they were caught as soon as they thought their company how to do the online accounting. First day he taught his company, he's caught, been embezzling for a year. People thought he was high on cocaine at home and getting his money not from stealing, which seemed impossible to them, he'd ever steal, but maybe almost equally impossible that he was selling drugs, which he wasn't, of course. I've seen children commit horrendous acts and hang themselves when the mania dissipates and turns into suicidal depression, or sometimes just going directly into suicidal depression. So the neurotoxin antidepressants, the SSRIs in particular, Wellbutrin as well, and Effexor and Prestique, the ones that can be stimulating can produce just very dangerous grandiosity and callousness and really asocial behaviors, turn a loving person into a violent person, turn an extremely ethical person into an amoral or immoral individual while under the influence of the drugs. And if this seems far-fetched to you, I mean, one of the simple ways to check it out is to go to any of the recent DSMs, Diagnostic and Statistical Manuals of Mental Disorders, put out by the APA, the Bible of Psychiatry. Look up manic episode. And you'll see all the horrific things that go with it. And then tucked in toward the end of the section on manic episodes, four or five pages into it, it'll say that these are also caused by medicines, including antidepressants. Anything that harms the brain, including ECT, can produce euphoria temporarily and potentially a manic episode. The drug company studies, I'm going to turn now to depression and suicide in children and adults caused by antidepressants. The Antidepressants, originally, when each of them was developed, was found not by the drug companies not to cause suicidal behavior. Actually, Eli Lilly found that it was causing suicidal behavior in their small controlled clinical trials for adults and just hid the data. You can find that on my website, and probably you can find it on the internet now, the Eli Lilly studies on suicide that they withheld. The FDA began to get the idea from epidemiological studies and clinical reports that the antidepressants, and from my work, I was really hammering on this. I was certainly the first person to begin hammering on this issue of antidepressant suicide. And the FDA decided to reevaluate all of the children's studies done for FDA approval. See, to get the drug actually approved, all you got to do is produce two studies, but you can have eight. Now, that's terrible science. I mean, in other words, the FDA knows you've done eight studies and only two showed marginal effectiveness, but they'll approve the drug. Whereas if a scientist looks at eight studies and only two are positive, he doesn't think the drug is working, especially when they're so poorly done and drug company done and manipulated. So the whole FDA process is a fraud. It's fake to get the drugs approved and out on the market. I want you to really think about that, because you may never have heard that before, that the companies can produce as many as they want, but if they can concoct two that show a marginal effect of this. Eli Lilly did it by cheating and giving addictive sedatives against the rules to their patients. And since they couldn't get the drug approved except with their illegal studies, the FDA let them use their two of their studies where the patients were taking addictive benzos to calm themselves down from all the overstimulation that many of them were getting. So we're just dealing with a farce here where you can do as many studies as you want, and all you need is two marginal ones, statistically significant, which doesn't necessarily prove much of anything, doesn't prove any clinical size effect, and you can get the drug approved. But as I said, if you're a scientist and you're looking at eight studies and only two show effectiveness, and they're done by the drug company, and all of them were done by the drug company trying to prove that they work, you're not going to accept that as evidence that the drugs really work, but the FDA just grabs it up. That's how their statutes are written. That's what they do. Now, of course, one of the things when you go to my antidepressant resource center, which again you'll find at the top of my website now under the heading for the selected highlights, you'll also find a section on they don't work. And you'll be able to pull up three articles right away. And that might lead you to some books as well, showing that if you look at all the studies, not just the two for approval, but all the studies done for the antidepressants, if you look at them all, they don't work. And this is, a pitiful situation. Given all the tremendous destructiveness done by the antidepressants. The title of my introduction to this new wonderful resource center is Antidepressants, Far More Harm Than Good. Because the neurotoxins, the antidepressants just produce an enormous number of adverse effects. But then you might say, but aren't the SSRIs, don't they specifically just affect serotonin and that's all related to depression? No, that's hooey. The whole biochemical theory, of course, is hooey. Just Google biochemical theory critiques, and you'll see wonderful ones. I started writing about them in 91. You'll see very good ones online, and whole books about them. My friend, the marvelous British psychiatrist Joanna Moncrief's got a whole book about it, as well as articles about it. And it doesn't make any sense to have thought that you could just pinpoint the serotonin neurotransmission and jack it up artificially. You flood the engine, Prozac and all the SSRIs, they prevent the removal of the neurotransmitter, that spark. They prevent its removal from the synapse. It's like preventing fuel from leaving an engine. That's not good for the engine. Eventually, the engine is going to sputter and spit and die on you. Well, when you do that to the brain, you block the removal of serotonin and flood the connections. It doesn't lead to an overall increase, interestingly enough, in serotonin. It's just in the animal brain, you can study it, it just gets shifted around unpredictable fashion. Changes occur in the brain. And the brain fights back and makes a variety of compensatory changes to overcome the effects. Meanwhile, the serotonin nerves are hardly being devoted to depression or keeping us bright and happy, are the most widespread neurotransmitter in the brain. They start deep in the brain in a raphe nuclei down the base of the brain, and they spread all the way around the brain. They go everywhere, including the frontal lobes. Along the way, they interconnect with the basal ganglia, same place the neuroleptics hit, and disrupt the basal ganglia and dopamine neurotransmission. By the time they're done, they're messing up frontal lobe function, the highest functions. They're messing them up directly and indirectly by themselves and with other neurotransmitters. A very sad state of affairs that psychiatric residents, other doctors, they aren't taught the stuff I'm telling you now. You probably know more now, in truth, about SSRIs than 95% of the prescribers from the short discussion. Spend a couple hours on the resource center, and I guarantee you, you'll know more than the prescribers throughout the country. Because you see, if you really knew, you'd stop prescribing. If you really knew that the studies actually have been showing for years that antidepressants don't work, that they're flattening agents, they give a little euphoria sometimes, and that's very dangerous, but mostly they just flatten people's emotions. That's why you can give them for anxiety, you can give them for OCD, you can give them for anything you want, pretty much. Except the person who's really already high, you better look out for that person because you might overstimulate him. But people give them to bipolar patients too, even though you give them to people who've had a manic episode or manic-like episode, then you'll get to a 20 or 30% chance of restarting a manic episode with these drugs. All this you can find readily on the website, the Resources Center. The introduction even has little references to scientific section 11 or scientific section 10, where you can find the information that bolsters the paragraphs in the introduction. You can see I'm really pleased and happy to be getting this up today. Let me think a minute about one more I want to tell you before I look a little more deeply at the issues with children. I think I'm covering it pretty well. I want to look at five studies. Don't close your eyes as if I'm about to talk about accounting procedures or bonds or something. I'll try to make this interesting for you. So imagine now it's 1991 and Prozac's been out for a little while. And you're at Yale, and you got all the top Yale people, many of them quite famous, Robert King, Mark Riddle, fellow named Larry Scahill, who's been involved in a lot of studies. I mean, you just see this bunch of people, big guys in child psychiatry, and they take a look at 42 of their young patients, age 10 to 17. So that's pre-adolescent little kids to 17-year-olds. And they decide to go over and look carefully at what sort of adverse reactions they got in a group of kids with obsessive compulsive disorder. This is at the University Research Center. And they apparently were surprised to find that the kids were hurting themselves, that self-injurious ideation or behavior appeared out of the blue, de novo, or got worse on Prozac in 6 out of 42 patients. In fact, four of them, that's a pretty good percentage out of 42. Four of them were hospitalized because of Prozac. Wow. I mean, this is like, let's stop giving this drug to kids. Oh, no. These guys didn't stop. Anybody read the article, which was in the famous Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry? The reason it's famous is it's famous for taking a ton of money from the drug companies and trying to go against FDA recommendations and give drugs to kids diagnosed ADHD at earlier ages than the FDA recommended. So they're a very famous organization. They think they're famous as the great academy. This should have stopped the whole thing. This is too high a risk. 14% of the patients, 4 out of 42 needing hospitalizations from Prozac, and all they had was OCD. It's not like they were psychotic, manic, or profoundly depressed. You expect kids with OCD not to be so mercurial or volatile. Well, it got worse. The same group, this time headed by Riddle, around the same time, looked at a group of 24 kids who had depressive or obsessive symptoms. 50% of them developed activation symptoms, excitation symptoms, 50%. And here's how it ran. Out of these 24 kids, motor restlessness in 11 of them on Prozac. Social inhibition, you know, like withdrawing and being sad in your room, 6 of the 24 kids. Subjective sensation of excitations, in other words, like amphetamine, which I write about in Talking Back to Prozac, was known inside the FDA from the beginning. The Prozac had amphetamine-like effects on lots of people and would be very dangerous. And the 3 of the kids who had ADHD got worse, showed more ADHD symptoms. And a lot of the kids got better by lowering the dose, but I'll bet you if I were there looking at them, I'd still see unwanted symptoms. And they make an important point. These side effects may be difficult to differentiate from common psychiatric symptoms like hyperactivity, restlessness, impulsivity. So right away, it's all set up back in 1991. 50% of kids are going to get overactive. Doctors won't be able to tell the difference between this and hyperactivity, restlessness, and impulsivity. They'll be put on sleeping pills for sleep. They'll be put on antidepressants when they collapse and get depressed. And they'll be put on antipsychotic drugs for their hyperactivity, restlessness, and impulsivity. So this is really, really a desperate situation. And I'm going to be putting up on the website in the next month or so a series of articles I've collected and some unpublished essays I've written around this issue of follow-up studies, because we got quite a few of them on ADHD kids, and that's just how they end up. They end up as adults using more psychiatric drugs, using more illegal drugs, more hospitalizations, more crime, lesser quality of life, and so on. Not because they were ADHD kids, but because they even got stimulants, but because it led to these antidepressants are leading to multiple drug use to handle the side effects, because as these Yale docs saw back in 1990-91 in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology, they probably couldn't get it published in the academy once they got up to 50% of their kids having these problems. Now, I know that Mark Riddlett, now at Hopkins, is a little more careful than some other child psychiatrists, but I don't know anybody in that field of child psychiatry in the U.S. You got Sammy Tamimi, for example, in Europe. He's recently been on his show. He's been on a few times. Child psych. But I don't know any child psychs in this country that are saying this is a terrible idea, giving all these drugs to kids. Well, how am I doing here? I've got plenty more time to talk to you. And I'm going to just do five of the studies here and give you an idea of how horrible we knew from the beginning that SSRIs were going to be. Here's another study out of the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. This one is from University of Pittsburgh, another very big research center, big supporter of child drugging. Big deal in that regard. They went and they reviewed 31 charts of hospitalized children and adolescents age 9 to 18. These kids had major mood disorders. By that, they must mean depression, bipolar disorder. Maybe they mean schizoaffective disorder. You all know I hope that the childhood bipolar disorder is a fiction created at Harvard's Child Psychopharmacology Center. They took a lot of money, including good old Joe over there. They took a lot. Joseph Biederman. They took a lot of money from the manufacturers of Risperdal, J&J, their subdivision Janssen. They took a lot of money under the table. I first started disclosing this years ago, and then the whole amounts, or larger amounts, were obtained, I think, at congressional hearings about it. That this whole bipolar disorder in children is just a concoction, literally bought by Johnson & Johnson through Harvard, especially Joseph Biederman. Well, here we are now. We're with a fellow named Jan, J-A-I-N, at the University of Pittsburgh. So they're looking at 31 hospitalized kids, 9 to 18 years old. Oh, they got all great clinical improvement. I'm not going to bother you with that, because we really know how much that can be trusted. We've got the research now that shows how ineffective these drugs are. So what were the most common adverse effects? Well, hypomanic symptoms in 23% of the kids. See, I'm not kidding you. Imagine that. Almost a quarter of the kids with manic-like symptoms, low level, hypomanic, that means just lower level. Irritability, which in psychiatry has a lot of danger associated with it, because it means overreacting with anger. So 19% overreacting with anger. Then they had a bunch of kids with gastrointestinal upset, but I'm not focusing on all the myriad bad things that are done. One of the reasons you get gastrointestinal upset and other serious problems is that the serotonin that the drug is messing with is not only in the brain, it's in the gut, it's in the bloodstream. Then they got 13% insomnia. And then they got discontinuation symptoms in 28% of the kids, including, again, irritability and hypomanic-like symptoms. They get you going up and they get you coming down. These symptoms of withdrawal that included the poor sleep and increased energy, increased stream of thoughts, racing thoughts. And listen to this. socially intrusive or obnoxious behavior. I've got the kids in legal cases and kids I've seen in my practice who indeed developed increased activity with socially intrusive or obnoxious behavior that got them in a lot of trouble. So here's another study. Now we'll jump ahead and we'll go, again, it's in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. We're in 2003. And now this is from the Boston group. This is from Timothy Weilands, Joseph Biederman, Tom Spencer, big deal guys. And they systematically evaluated the medical charts of children treated with SSRIs for depression or OCD. This is Harvard, but it sounds a lot like the Yale studies. And I'm trying to look at the age. The age was, mean age was 12.2, plus or minus 3.2 years. So, God, it's roughly running from about 9 years old to about 15 years old. And they were examined for medication, adverse effects, behavioral effects. And they found them in 22% of their kids, looking back over their charts. And these abnormalities were not based even on dose. I mean, that's really important. Not on dose, not on age, not on sex, not even on concurrent medications, or even on a specific SSRI, because by now we've got more SSRIs than just Prozac going on out there. They had several in this study. I think probably Zoloft, maybe Paxil. I'm not sure about Celexa. I mean, this is a very serious matter. And some of these were very serious adverse effects that were causing these kids, you know, psychological and social problems. I mean, how can we give this stuff to kids? Go to the Resource Center, look up one of my recent articles, which says it's time to stop giving psychoactive substances to children. You'll get a good understanding why today, why I think we should just stop giving psychoactive substances to children. They're neurotoxins. Why do we want to poison our kids? And by the way, when they stopped the medications, the kids got better. And when they restarted them, 44% of them, 18 of them, got worse again. What a bummer. Now, here's the final study I'm going to take you through so you can brighten your eyes up. And this is by a great Australian psychiatrist and his team, John Giuriadini. You've heard him on my radio show. And remember, you can go to my radio show archives off my website, and there you will get a built-in search mechanism, and you can look up John Giuriadini and see what he said, or the Sammy Tamimi, whom I mentioned, or Joanna Moncrief. And, you know, some of them have several shows they've been on. Now, this final study is by Giuriadini. It's called Efficacy and Safety of Antidepressants for Children and Adolescents. And I'm going to just read you, and it's going to be the end of my reading today. Well, maybe one little more thing. Summary points. Investigators' conclusions on the efficacy of newer antidepressants and childhood depression have exaggerated their benefits. They're exaggerating, guys. Is that a surprise? Improvement in control groups is strong. So the control groups are getting better. Same rate, probably. I know the same rate as the Prozac groups, but they're not getting horrible adverse effects. And so it concludes additional benefit from drugs is of doubtful clinical significance. They don't think there's any clinical significant improvement on drugs. They conclude also, quote, adverse effects have been downplayed. then they say, antidepressant drugs cannot confidently be recommended as a treatment option for childhood depression. This is John Giriadini. He's a director of the Department of Psychological Medicine, Women and Children's Hospital, North Adelaide, Australia. Widely published man. Now, another thing you'll find on the website, the Resources Center website, now available, the Antidepressant Resources Center website. For those of you who've just tuned in, this is Peter Bregan doing the whole show by myself. If you've been waiting for the guest to come on, if you tuned in after the first 5 minutes and you're wondering, where's the guest? Where's the guest? No guest today. I've also included a few, and I'm going to have many more in there, of the FDA-approved full prescribing information. That's that big, long thing we call also called the package insert, and officially known as the label. In the FDA documents, it's called the label. Well, when the FDA was holding hearings on depression, I test on suicide from antidepressants in children, I said we got a much bigger problem than just the suicidality. These drugs act like amphetamines and overstimulate children, produce an activation or stimulant syndrome. I testified to that. And the head of the executive head, not the medical head, the executive head at the FDA of the committee decided to honor me by sending every committee member an article I wrote in 2003-2004 on antidepressant induced violence, suicide, violence and suicide mania. You can get that also, PDF, download easily off of the Antidepressant Resources Center on my website, Bregan.com. And a lot of what's in the label reads as if those two dozen committee members who got my article did read it, because it almost is like very close to word for word from my article. And this is some of what they say. In the black label, they talk about the increased risk to compared to placebo of suicidal thinking and behavior in children, adolescents, and young people. And then they go on and they say this: patients of all ages who are started on antidepressant therapy should be monitored appropriately and observed closely for clinical worsening. How'd you like to take a drug and get clinical worsening? For clinical worsening, suicidality, or other unusual changes in behavior. Families and caregivers should be advised of the need for close observation and communication with the prescriber. Well, folks, I mean, that's a really great idea. Let's hope all the doctors are doing it with all their patients, closely monitoring them, explaining to them clinical worsening, unusual changes in behavior. And this occurs especially in the initial few months of a course of treatment or at times of dose changes, either increases or decreases. I was writing about that before it was in the label. Now, here's the part that was very much taken from my talks to the FDA and from the paper they got. This is what the FDA says. This is still under, all this is under the sections on warnings and precautions, which by statute have to be based on a reasonable degree of causation. This is what the FDA says. The following symptoms: anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, irritability, hostility, aggressiveness, impulsivity, akathisia — they put in parentheses for akathisia, psychomotor restlessness, and now continuing with the list — akathisia, psychomotor restlessness, hypomania, and mania have been reported in adult and pediatric patients being treated with antidepressants for major depressive disorder, as well as — now listen to this, this gives you a huge warning. So it's give This happens in people with major depressive disorder, as well as for other indications, both psychiatric and non-psychiatric. So you can have a non-psychiatric problem, and maybe you're given an SSRI for pain. You know, I've seen them, people given them because they thought they were too sexual, because they so horribly suppress sexuality. You'll find those references also and on the Resource Center, and explaining how the suppression of sexuality can, and this is so tragic, can become permanent. So that's the subheading for that little bit of information, is the condition, is the subheading about worsening condition. And then it goes on and it says, families and caregivers of patients being treated. This is the official FDA label and recommendations. This is right out of the corrupt horse's mouth. Family and caregivers of patients being treated with antidepressants for major depressive disorder or other indications, both psychiatric and non-psychiatric. So whatever you're being given this drug for, you may not be a mental patient, may not have psychiatric problems, but you and your family should be alerted about the need to monitor patients for the emergence of agitation, irritability, unusual changes in behavior, and the other symptoms described as above, which, by the way, included mania, hostility, aggression, as well as the emergence of suicidality, and to report such symptoms immediately to healthcare providers. Such monitoring should include daily observation by families and caregivers. Do you think that doctors all over the country, who have, obviously they've all read this, haven't they? And they're all just monitoring their little hearts out. At the end of, let me take a sip of water, folks. I don't have a guest to do the talking for me. Thank you. There's a medication guide appended to all of the antidepressants now, and it's something that can be printed out on a page, and it has a wealth of warnings for the family and patients that the doctor is supposed to discuss with the family and patients, including a special warning about the drugs causing hypomania and mania. And this is the last thing I am going to read to you, and it's rather poignant. This is a paragraph out of the medication guide that your doctor supposedly shared with you when you got your antidepressant, and with your family, even if you're not a child, because these drugs can make you so disturbed you won't even remember or care what the doctor told you. So here's the paragraph. Call your healthcare provider right away if you have any of the following symptoms, or call 911 if an emergency, especially if they are new, worse, or worry you. Here's the list of things to be aware of when you take your antidepressants, especially soon after starting them or changing the dose. Here come the list. Attempts to commit suicide. Acting on dangerous impulses. Acting aggressive or violent, thoughts about suicide or dying, new or worse depression, new or worse anxiety or panic attacks, feeling agitated, restless, angry, or irritable, trouble sleeping, an increase in activity or talking more than what is normal for you, and finally, listen to this one, other unusual changes in behavior or mood. In other words, all kinds of crazy, horrible stuff, unpredictably so, can routinely happen to you taking these drugs. And in children, the rates are staggering. And furthermore, withdrawal from these drugs is dangerous, so it's also not a good idea to go ahead and to stop taking these drugs without clinical supervision from somebody who's wise and experienced. and somebody who is going to really put your interests at the top of his or her list of priorities. I want to go down with you the subjects covered in the scientific section, where there are paper after paper. The first is antidepressants can cause or worsen mania and psychosis. We got more than a dozen there. Antidepressant-induced suicide. This is mostly adults' materials because the child stuff is already confirmed on the labels. I got a couple dozen there. Adverse effects of antidepressants on children and youth. I've got the ones I summarized for you. I even have the Zoloft label with some of the highlights I quoted you in that section. The fourth one is just examples of the full prescribing information, the label. I've got a few of those throughout here. And I've got a list of my articles on antidepressants starting in 1992, when I published one of the very first articles on Prozac suicidality and anxiety during withdrawal. I've got about 3, 6, 9, 12, maybe 18 articles there. I'm not sure, 15. Number six is antidepressant ineffectiveness. I've got 7 articles there by about six or seven different people showing the ineffectiveness. Got a special section on brain damage and embryonic damage. That's sad for you, huh? Long-term exposure to neurotoxins is not good for the brain. We have too many studies showing harm to the brain from antidepressant drugs in both children and adults. Children and adults. I got a section on discontinuation or withdrawal. I got about a dozen in there or more. I got a series of articles on violence caused by antidepressants, including this new work that's being done by a couple of really good people, Lucier and Eichelenboom, both of whom I know. They are exploring and demonstrating that many people, maybe 10 or 20% of the population, lack the enzymes in the liver necessary to prevent abnormal metabolism of a drug. So what happens if you're missing some of these enzymes and you take a 20 milligram dose of Prozac is the liver won't be able to break it down. And it will, the dose might be 2 or 3 times larger than it's supposed to be. So if you're already getting a large dose, then you're going to be getting a really very, very, very large dose. Another great article in that section is by another person I know well, Thomas Moore, and Joe Glenn Mullen. And they looked at the violence rates for all drugs sent to the FDA. And one of the things that proves that it's not caused by the mental illness, so-called, of the patients, but by the drugs, is that the highest rate was found, violence was found in varenicline. Which is a smoking prevention drug, and even antibiotics. Some antibiotics were in there, but right at the top were antidepressants as well. And then the subject is number 10 is antidepressant induced apathy in children and adults. We now have a very large body of material showing that antidepressants, very much like antipsychotic drugs. Also stimulants, so just about any drug, lithium and almost any drug, actually marijuana, alcohol, that over time they make you less caring and apathetic. We got a bunch of articles there about apathy induced in children and adults and even chronic depression induced by the antidepressant drugs, not acute depression, which we already see in the label, but chronic depression produced by the antidepressant drugs. One article is a good one, is by John Reed, that you, whom you've heard on the radio show, and you can look up in the on the radio show link on my website. It's in the selected highlights, and then you can search for him and listen to his radio show. And then number 11 is a persistent sexual dysfunction. And then I got a section where I'm going to be putting miscellaneous items into, just in general. So that's the basic story of the antidepressant website. I leave you with a couple of what I think are really important thoughts and observations. Why are we giving these drugs to children, ever? Why? Because society has a very sick attitude toward drugs, toward children, toward anybody who's supposedly mentally ill, and on and on and on. I mean, it's a tragedy that requires the wisdom of Solomon to understand, plus a few sociologists, psychologists, and other folks. Given these drugs to children, I'm very proud to have called for a moratorium on giving psychoactive substances to children. And it's hard to know which are worst for the kids, you know, the antipsychotic drugs, the antidepressants, the stimulants, the mood stabilizers. Very hard to know. Another is, would an informed adult take these drugs? How many adults, knowing this, just knowing that they have a high risk of sexual dysfunction, more than 50% if people are questioned carefully, how many adults would take these drugs? How many? Would you want to? And finally, remember, coming off these drugs abruptly is a catastrophe. If you've been on them for a week, yeah, just stop them and get some decent therapy help. But if you've been on them for weeks or months, they're very dangerous to come off of. So you got to be careful about that with both your children and yourself. I've seen kids who, during the withdrawal period, had one last outburst of violence, and the parents have trusted me enough to believe that, let's just give them another week. Give your little boy or girl another week. Give them a week. Let's see if he gets through it. And usually they do. They do. And a new person emerges. A new child emerges when I take them off of antidepressant drugs. And believe it or not, new adults emerge. Renewed adults emerge. Listen, thank you for listening to this. This is probably the most passionate show I've ever given. It's fueled by what I see in my practice, what I see in my legal work, what I see just listening to people I meet casually. It's a catastrophe, all these drugs we're on. So many women, I haven't talked about that. So many, many women taking these drugs. Estimates of 20% or more. We just need to reevaluate what we're doing, and we need to return to believing in ourselves, believing in one-to-one therapy and help and counseling and spiritual guidance and all the good things in life, love, family life, supporting each other. There's just so many ways to deal with this thing called depression, and the neurotoxins called antidepressants are not one of the good ones. Thank you so much, folks. Thanks a lot for listening. This is Dr. Peter Breggin saying goodbye.